This is an ABC podcast.
Live across Victoria.
On ABC Listen.
Your smart speaker.
And on your radio.
This is 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
The conversations that are important to you.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
Have you ever been to Don Bosco in Brunswick? Do you know what I'm talking about? The iconic low-key youth centre, and there's a hostel as well in the inner north. After 87 years, Don Bosco looks set to be sold. The whole property is on the market and it's sparked an online petition. Do we care about youth centres anymore? Is it important to keep them going? Give me a call about the role of youth centres and, in particular, Don Bosco. What are your memories there or experiences? Are you still taking your kids there? I know there is still kids' parties happening in Don Bosco. I fully admit I have spent countless hours there a while ago now, but when my kids were little, it was frankly old-fashioned fun. No airs and graces about it. There was air hockey. There are pool tables as well, built-in trampolines into the ground. Was never super busy. That was part of the joy of it. But maybe that's why it's being sold. Is that good enough? What do we lose when we lose our youth centres? I would love to know your memories or experiences of Don Bosco. How do you feel about this news? Did you or do you take your kids there? Call me up, let me know. Also, as we speak in Melbourne and across Victoria, public school teachers and principals are striking. We're going to cross live to the march in Melbourne CBD. Now, this is a second strike in 4 months after the educators narrowly voted down a revised government pay offer. They rejected 17% back in March over 3 years, and then they rejected 28.3% over 4 years. In April. Tell me what you think of it. What are you doing today to cope with it? We will cover some of those issues today on The Conversation Hour and a lot more as well. Mark, you've called in from Coburg. What do you think about the news about Don Bosco?
Yeah, it's incredibly tragic. It's been at the heart of the community for about 87 years, and my two kids have grown up there. We've made friends there, gone to numerous birthday parties. And it really performs a really important function in the area. It's free or cost-free for families that, you know, live in an apartment or a small place and they don't have room to host a birthday party. It's often like the really happy backdrop to many kids' childhoods, and we really don't want to lose it from our community.
Did you know about this? Was there any communication to the people who are going there, Mark?
Look, I'd heard murmurs, but when the sign went up recently, it kind of confirmed, our worst fears. We think, so a bunch of parents have banded together very quickly. There's a petition circulating. I think it's been up for about 24 hours and it's already over about 2,000 signatures. So there's a real groundswell of support, including from parents. And, you know, there's a group of dads who went there as children who now take their children there as adults. And it's just really been, you know, and it's not just for younger children, it's for youth in the area as well, to have a place where they can hang out, that's safe, that's inclusive. And, you know, it's run by a religious order, but it's always felt like a place where everyone can go, irrespective of background or, you know, where they're from or how much money's in their pocket.
And, Mark, I was remarking on my memories, which is that it's just so delightfully analog, if you like.
Yes.
Do you think that that's part of the thing that would be lost?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's almost too wholesome. There's a rabbit that comes out to be patted. I'm assured the rabbit is a happy rabbit and well socialised. There used to be a sheepdog that was really well trained that came out. So often it was like kids' first safe interaction and learning how to interact with an animal. The in-ground trampolines are amazing. And, yeah, look, even the big, you might remember the big plastic boxes of Lego in Duplo.
Oh, yeah.
And so you'd have a bunch of kids just sitting around together with potentially sticky fingers from MSC monkeys just getting into it. So, yeah, it's a great, it's kind of like a stepping back into the past, but also a place that's really valued in the present because it's not about screens, it's just about you know, those toddlers, they need exercise, and when it's raining, being able to get them to bounce on a trampoline for half an hour can really make a huge difference in bad weather.
Mm. And so, Mark, you'll be signing this petition, it sounds like.
Yeah, absolutely, and circulating widely. And, you know, I think there's a bit of a... If you look at the petition, it's basically a push for the local council, but also the state government, to think about how it can be kept in community hands.
Yep.
Because, you know, if the sale has to go ahead, it's been such a gift to the community. We need more high-density housing, like first to say it, but we also need, you know, infrastructure that supports young families who are living in high density, particularly if they don't have a backyard of their own.
That's right. Mark, thank you so much for calling in. Really interesting to get that insight. As you say, the petition calls on the local Marybeck Council and the state government to do something about this. We've asked the state government for a comment this morning. They declined. We're still waiting to hear from the council. We still haven't got details also from the current owners as to the circumstances of this. We'll keep looking into it as well. But as I say, there is that online petition. You're on The Conversation Hour on 774 ABC Melbourne and Victoria. I'm asking you across Victoria, not just about this one youth centre in Brunswick, but how important are these youth centres? I'd love to know. Samantha Ratnam, you know her. She's the former Greens leader, well known around Brunswick as well, and social worker. And she is on this case as well. And she joins me now. Hello, Samantha.
Oh, hi, Mary. Lovely to speak to you.
I believe you are around that teachers' march, which we'll ask you about in a moment.
Indeed.
But if people are wondering about any noise,
yes.
What did you think when you heard about this news about Don Bosco?
Oh, I was so sad to see that for sale sign go up over the last week. And I was listening to Mark before as well. And there had been some murmurs about this, but it was really a shock to see it and see the timeline. I think there's about a four-week window that they're hoping to get expressions of interest. But it's such a treasured place for our community. People come from near and far. I'm sure you're going to hear that throughout the morning. And people have come for decades on, you know, decades now to visit that place. It holds a very special place in many people's hearts, particularly families. It's a, you know, free space for young people to burn off some energy, connect with others. And there's also youth workers there, which is a real rare thing nowadays.
We have been talking about Don Bosco, 1300 222 774. If you still go there, hold your kids' parties there. If you used to, it's been there for 87 years. It is set to be sold. Samantha Ratnam is with us now. As Mark alluded to, Samantha, you've got a situation, particularly in the inner urban areas, of a lack of affordable housing. This is prime real estate, and there's a lot of it as well. Do you suspect that this is what it would end up as? And as such, is this a sort of a momentum that you can't really stop if you've got a, you know, lightly used youth centre model to compete with that?
Oh, look, we definitely need more housing everywhere, and these are prime locations for more housing. So the community absolutely welcomes that. It's interesting, though, the site has been used for low-cost, you know, sometimes short to medium-term accommodation. The hostel part has been also there for decades on end, and we're hearing lots of stories about what that accommodation meant for a lot of people who otherwise not would have not been able to afford a roof over their heads when they were students and young people, et cetera. That being said, I don't think the community would say no to housing at that site, but what the push is on for now is to secure that site, that youth centre specifically, and you know, maybe we could have both, but it's going to take a lot of community rallying, and that's why the call is on the state government and the council to work together to see if we can secure that youth space for young people for the future. It doesn't mean that there can't be housing as well.
Right, so you're talking about a split space for that. Would you want to keep the original building for that in your ideal iteration of that?
Oh, well, we've been talking, I heard before as well, about how beautifully analog the space is. Well,
yes.
I think there'll be a lot of people who would be very, you know, attached to the way it is. I mean, things move and change, but I think it's the essence of that place, which is free or low-cost third spaces for young people. And I know you're asking the question about how important these spaces are more generally across the city. And they are are really important. We have fewer and fewer spaces now where young people can go, which are not shopping malls, where you're not being pushed to purchase, and that's how you spend your recreational time and social time, where there are actually spaces where you can connect for free, meet other young people. There are youth workers there who actually get to know you, and I've been there on many afternoons with my young one. You know, it saved us as well on many a rainy day. But what I've loved the most is seeing the interactions between people, and you can really tell that people know each other because they keep coming there after school, and I'm already hearing from a lot of people who say, I go there after school, where would I go if this place wasn't there?
Will you be involving yourself in this campaign? It sounds like you are already.
Absolutely. I've been doing whatever I could to support Don Bosco for a number of years now, and we want to ensure that these spaces are there for young people in the future as well. They've serviced generations before, and we want it to be able to service generations in the future as well. So we'll be doing everything that we can to support. Hopefully council and the state government can start having some talks as urgently as possible to think about how we can preserve this space.
And before I let you go, Samantha Ratnam, as I said, you've made your way to the teachers' rally in the city.
Yes.
Now, this, what strikes us about this, obviously the second strike in 4 months, they've turned down a deal narrowly. Do you believe that the educators are potentially on the verge of losing, you know, some of that social, the undoubted social support that they've had on this issue?
Well, judging by the thousands upon thousands of people, which I can see from where I'm sitting, I found a little quiet space, but I can see the thousands of people, and we're going to join the march as soon as I finish this call. I don't think they're losing support. In fact, I think they're gaining support, and they certainly have my support, and they have the support of our local community. As a parent myself of a young person in the public system, I think this is what this is protesting the woeful underfunding of our public schools for decades on end. And teachers and education staff have been keeping that system up while literally the walls were cracking around them in many instances. We're talking not just about the infrastructure, though. We're talking about the resources they have to provide the best quality education to our young people. And they have been trying to patch things up for years on end, and they haven't got that support. So it's both about salary and conditions, but it's also about properly funding our public schools. And you know, in Victoria, the state government has delayed its commitment to fully funding our public schools, which is potentially ripping out $2.4 billion over the next few years from our public schools. So I think it's about all of that.
Samantha Ratnam, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Samantha Ratnam, former Greens member, leader, should I say, and social worker as well, and still involved, as you can hear. I'm asking about Don Bosco. Samantha's involved in that response. Are you also someone who has loved and would miss Don Bosco for all youth centres? Do we care about them anymore? You tell me. Kevin, you're in Brunswick. What do you think about it? Hello, Kevin.
Oh, hi. How are you doing today?
Yeah, good, thank you. How are you?
Good. I'm a resident of Brunswick. I've lived here for 40 years. I have to admit, I've never been to the Don Bosco because I'm in my early 60s now. But I used to go, Don Bosco used to run a boys' retreat in summertime down at Safety Beach for years. I don't know if maybe your listeners male listeners, of course, may have known about this. They ran it for about a month. It's
did
summertime.
You used to go, Kevin?
Oh, yeah, I went there for about 5 years. Yeah.
Was it? What do you remember of it?
Well, it was fantastic. It was, you know, it was much like what happens with the facility in Sydney Road. Is this boys getting together, going to the beach, sporting activities, we'll watch films. It was just, you know, good, wholesome,
good old screen-free fun.
Yeah, definitely. And it cost, but it was incredibly cheap for its time.
Yeah.
So, and boys from different areas. It wasn't about this area, that area. It was just boys from all around metropolitan Melbourne.
Kevin, thank you. Yeah, part of life potentially at risk. Do you remember those summer retreats? Do you remember Don Bosco? I'd love to hear from you. Do you know about the rabbit? I don't know that I saw the rabbit. Let me know. Tell me about your feelings about Don Bosco and also youth-run centres or those sorts of youth centres across the state. Should we have more of them? We'll keep on that story. And also we're going to, in this conversation now, be talking about that story. Did you hear about it? AI going rogue in real life. What role would our new brand spanking new AI plan in Australia have to tackle that or prevent that? Also, I'm asking today, are our kids becoming less entrepreneurial? But next, we will cross to the CBD to hear more from the Teachers March.
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
You are listening to The Conversation Hour on 774 Melbourne and ABC. Very soon we'll be getting a bit of analysis from the point of view of Adam Voigt. He's the CEO of Real Schools. Kate Mead is our station reporter. She's at the rally. What's it like there, Kate?
Well, Mary, I'm standing on the steps of Parliament House this morning and I cannot see any space in front of me on Spring Street, and it stretches as far as the eye can see down to Swanston Street. There is room for people to walk on the footpath, but the road is packed. It is a sea of red. Standing where I am, though, behind me, there is two sets of couples that got married today trying to get their photo in amongst all of this on the stairs. I'm just going to walk away from them at the moment while they try and pose for this. And they said they might even get the protest in the background just because it's happened on their day. But
they don't need you photobombing them, let alone thousands of teachers. But what can they do?
What can they do, right? And amongst this sea of red, I'm looking at schools from all over the state. Just in front of me, I can see Point Cook and Copperfield. Down the back, I can see Wyndham and I can see Doherty's Creek, Fountain Gate, Ballarat, Strawton. From all over Victoria, they have come to stand together.
And where do they plan to go and how long will the disruption be today, apart from people getting married, Kate?
Well, look, at the moment, speeches have just begun. So they met at Bourke Street in the Mall at about 10:30 and they've just arrived here only minutes ago. So I'm expecting a few more speeches before this crowd disperses and interruptions from Spring Street right through the Mall, right down to Swanston Street and right through Bourke Street this afternoon.
Thank you, Kate.
Thanks, Mary.
That's Kate Mead, ABC Melbourne Station reporter. Joining me now is Adam Voigt, who is CEO of Real Schools. Thank you so much. We've heard there, Adam, that rally is certainly well attended and loud and as vociferous as the previous one within the past few months. What do you think about this situation with the teachers' strike in Melbourne and Victoria at the moment?
Yeah, good morning, Mary. I must admit there's a little bit of irony for me, and I think every photo that every teacher has ever taken has had somebody trying to bomb it in the background or giving rabbit ears behind someone's head. So
this is revenge.
I feel only a little bit for those married couples that are trying to get their photos taken on the steps. My broad take is that I think there's a sentiment in Victoria when it comes to this that they want to be able to support the teachers, but there's a little feel also of, I think, some parents. I remember my mum used to say to myself and one of my sisters, I felt she wanted to bang our heads together and tell us to go and sort it out. She didn't want to hear any more from either of us. And I think there's a little bit of that. I think that this is something that should have been sorted out well in advance of today. We've got a government who needs to acknowledge that there are, our graduate teachers are starting $13,000 in salary below their compatriots, say in the Northern Territory. We've got ES staff, education support staff, who in our residualised government schools are so important, who are not getting a fair hearing on their pay concerns and are being offered a small allowance to kind of try and get that vote over the line. And then on the other side of it, we've got a union who's clearly a little bit in disarray. This is 40 years since we've had a union negotiated agreement with the government, basically knocked back by the membership. And so there's a lack of coherence in the messaging and in the way that teachers are coming together on this. So there's a lot of factional infighting and leadership trouble there that needs to be sorted out, because we need to get our teachers and our schools functioning the way we want them to.
Yeah, on that industrial relations point, it was quite notable.
from your point of view, real schools, you deal with primary, secondary and other schools to talk about culture and student behaviour, but you will have seen, I guess, industrial relations play out across the board. Can you expand a little on what you think is happening, I guess not just literally within the union, but I guess in terms of teachers and how they're feeling and this divide, almost 50-50 divide on this issue?
Yeah, that's right. It's really close. We're really actually talking about a few hundred votes on the survey that went out this week. So my view is you have to take a bit of an historical view of it, Mary, which means at least going back to, you know, the 2022 EBA that was negotiated, which ended up for teachers, there was a lot of not so much great will that came out of that because the rates of pay that were offered to teachers were outstripped by inflation. So they found themselves a few years down the track in a worse position than they're in now, which is why they're kind of arguing that the government's current pay offer around 28% over 7 years is kind of, you know, is not going to do that job if inflation continues to rise the way that it is at the moment. And they're going to find themselves back in the same position again in a few years' time. I think the other contributing factor here for teachers, when I talk to them a lot out there, is that one of the big things that they want to have recognised through this, and this is where I think this isn't just a Victorian phenomenon, I think it's a bit of a sentinel call out there for the rest of the country, is that teachers are really sick of about a 30-year decline in the way that our governments at a federal and a state level have supported government education. You know, these schools are residualised, the funding has increased for the independent and private school sector way higher than it has for our government schools. I think they're saying we're catering for the kids who need an education the most and with the most complexity, and we're not getting a fair deal. And I think they've reached a point where, frankly, enough's enough, and they're prepared to dig in over it this time around.
Adam Voigt, great to speak with you today.
My pleasure. Thanks, Mary.
That's Adam Voigt, who's CEO of Real Schools, that work to build school culture. What do you think? Also today, we've been talking about Don Bosco. It's an institution in Brunswick, even if you haven't been there in the past 87 years when it's been there on Sydney Road. Maybe you know other youth centres like it. What do you think of youth centres? Are they more important than ever, potentially? Don Bosco, your memories. Jane from Woolamai, what do you remember or know of Don Bosco?
My experience, hello there.
Hello.
My experience with Don Bosco was our older son, who is now 35. He came down from the country. At that stage, we were living up in central Victoria, so about 3 hours away from Melbourne. And he boarded at Don Bosco for the first 2 years when he went off to RMIT to study.
Oh, right.
University. Yeah, so
a big part of his life.
It was, because it was a lovely community, and a lot of boys boarded there, country kids especially.
Yeah. Did you? So where did they board? It wasn't in Sydney Road, was it?
Yeah.
In Sydney Road, right.
Yeah, in the youth club was adjacent to
the accommodation. It's a hostel now, I believe.
Yeah.
So what do you think about this passing potentially into private hands after 87 years?
Well, like most things, when they get privatised, that, one-on-one and community feel always gets lost. Back then, I think it was Brother John was the person who looked after the boys, and they had community meals together, like they supplied them meals at night. It was basic accommodation, but for country kids, my kids were lucky, they went to boarding school in a regional town, but then they went to Melbourne. But
so much a part of their lives. Jane, thank you so much for sharing your story, and we will get to more stories, hopefully, about Don Bosco. 1300 222 774 is the number to call on the Conversation Hour. Also, we're covering in this hour whether our kids are actually becoming less entrepreneurial, and a little look at the Indian Film Festival in Melbourne. It's unbelievable. But next, did you hear about that story about the bot that went rogue? Have we got the plans that can stop it? That's next.
One prize that includes tickets to the MIF opening night, MTC's Uncle Vanya, Mrs. Doubtfire, and more. Listen this week for your chance to win the golden ticket on 774 ABC Melbourne.
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
Didn't hear it this morning. This is what happened. OpenAI said, look, they had AI offline. They were doing some experiments with it, if you like. It was contained, or so they thought. It broke out and it hacked a digital library. Now, do we have the plans? We've got a brand spanking new national AI plan, an AI Safety Institute. What role could it or would it have done in this situation if this is indeed something that we're looking at in the future? David Rowe is head of AI and security at the Australian Strategic Policy Institute and joins me now. Thanks for joining me, David.
Thanks, Mary.
So from what you heard about what happened, is this going to happen a lot?
Yeah, I think it's a growing risk because, I mean, there are two broad trends that we need to pay attention to. One is that AI models are becoming smarter. They're getting more powerful and more capable. At the same time, we're also giving them greater latitude to act autonomously and independently and carry out higher and higher level tasks without, you know, direct human intervention. And they will take the best pathway they see to get to the goal that we've set them. So in this case, we just said, okay, complete this cyber hacking test within your, you know, sort of digital prison that we've put you inside. And rather than sitting there and completing the test, it decided the best way to do this was to break out of the cage, go on, you know, get onto the internet, which it did very, very cleverly by finding a, a vulnerability basically in the infrastructure that was containing it, break into another platform, Hugging Face, this online library that you mentioned, using, you know, very smart means, in order to steal the answers. Now, that's not what, you know, nobody told it to do that, but it just decided that was the best way to get a good result on the test.
We told the bot to do its best, and it did.
And it did, and OpenAI got more than they were bargaining for. But, you know, as we give it higher and higher level goals, this is going to happen more and more often. It's not going to necessarily go from point A to point C via point B, as we anticipate it will. It'll find some other circuitous means that might be harmful in order to get there.
And part of the reporting about, as I said, this new AI plan that we have and the institute that we are going to form, and as I say, it's still a very new concept, but if we can do a thought experiment here and see whether our plans actually will be useful, the AI Safety Institute, as I have been reading it, are supposed to make sure that AI systems and agents that work with AI act in ways that are, quote, aligned with their users' values and goals. So does that mean mandating the sort of instructions, if you like, that should happen in all of these circumstances? And how would that, how powerful would that structure of regulation be in Australia when it comes to these large multinational companies?
Yeah, it's a good question. So the Institute's role here will be kind of over the long term in helping to contribute to international research on what's called alignment. I'm not sure, you might have mentioned it there in your description, but alignment basically means getting AIs to do what we want them to, and not including to achieve the goals that we set for them without, you know, resorting to, you know, sort of strange avenues, as has happened here. The Institute is doing some work on that. So, for instance, they're collaborating with the CSIRO on AI alignment. They're also collaborating with a non-profit called the Gradient Institute, who do work on AI safety, on something called multi-agent risk, which is a technical term, but basically meaning, I mean, it's one thing to control a single agent, as OpenAI was trying to do here, but imagine when there are millions of agents out there in the real world, all interacting with the real world, interacting with each other, bouncing off one another, and so forth. That's called, that's a multi-agent situation that throws up all sorts of four-dimensional risks of its own. So they're doing some work on that as well. The like you say, it's a relatively new body. You know, Australia has some great people, and I'm sure they will make a valuable contribution. They are basically, though, contributing to what is a global effort here. And given that there are only two countries on the planet that are building frontier models, and that's the United States and China, at some point, it's very difficult to see this coming under control and giving us the kind of sense of safety and assurance that we want until those two countries come together and figure out exactly how they're going to proceed safely with frontier AI development and research. So, the companies doing the building the models and the governments that oversee them are at some stage going to have to figure out, okay, how do we keep doing work and releasing it in a way that isn't getting too far ahead of the safety measures. So again, the Institute, the Australian Institute, will make a contribution, but it's a big global conversation.
Indeed. And I guess what this does is it's a real life experiment, as I say, thought experiment. I'm finding it hard as you speak, David, to get my head around how a country like Australia, with, as you say, even the brightest minds and reaching out to the US and even to China in terms of cooperation, how we can actually influence those sort of parameters of safety.
We have to do it at a number of levels. We have to do the research and contribute that to the global conversation. We have to use our diplomatic clout, particularly, obviously nobody's having a lot of success at the moment trying to direct the US diplomatically. But, we are a close ally and, we do. And look, in the international environment, we do actually have some clout. Like, we are seen as as a good global citizen who brings sort of practical, sensible solutions to the table in global conversation. So I think we can rest on, we can draw on our diplomatic capital to try and influence the discussion here. While contributing to the research and the science at the same time. But it's
still a long way to go.
it is a long way to go because we are frankly, and unabashedly a tech middle power in this space. But the other thing one final thing to point out is that if we grow our leverage as an AI power, that does actually buy us more of a seat at the table in these sorts of global safety conversations. Now, there's a big discussion going on about data centers and the extent to which we should host data centers here for the purposes of training and running big American frontier models. I'm very strongly of the view that we should be involved in that. That's it's important to our sort of economy and our economic security, but it does also give us some leverage.
A bit more of a seat at the table.
Over how the global industry actually runs. Like, if the Americans are dependent on us to train their models because the data centers are here, that gives us a lot more say and a lot more leverage in those conversations. So I think that's, becoming part of the industry is an important part of it.
That is another and very important conversation, David. I'm sure we haven't ended it there. Thank you so much for helping us today.
Welcome, Mary.
That's David Rowe, Head of AI and Security at the Australian Strategic Policy Institute. What do you think about that? Tony and someone says, who's liable and takes responsibility when AI does the wrong thing? That will also be an open question. I'm asking you today also about Don Bosco. It's a youth centre and a hostel. We're talking particularly about the youth club that is on Sydney Road. First time in 87 years it's on the market. We have tried to get input from the state and council governments. They have not been able to join us today. We're looking for some more information about this sale. What do you think about Don Bosco? A lot of nostalgia for that place today. Brendan in Bayside, you have another but different experience of Don Bosco.
Yes, thanks for taking my call. It was quite interesting when I listened to your program this morning because I was in Sicily with my son-in-law and my daughter and grandson, and Mount Etna erupted and we were caught in Sicily for another 4 days.
So, oh, dear.
Yeah, which wasn't too shabby, but the airport was absolutely packed, so we decided to get a hotel motel for the night, and it turned out to be Don Bosco. An absolutely brilliant old motel, and it was right on the beach, and they catered for lots of school groups and the history was right throughout the corridors. So, yeah, just a little bit interesting.
Oh, that's really interesting. Did they have built-in trampolines and a rabbit, though? That's the question, well, Brendan.
They had a soccer, an indoor soccer stadium. And they also, outdoor I should say, but it was covered. And they also had lots of water activities and lots of animals like peacocks. And
there you go. It might be part of the Don Bosco algorithm there, the plan.
And the staff were absolutely brilliant. They were so helpful. And the place was a little bit so I might need a tidy up, and hopefully it's not going to be soft like the one in Melbourne, but anyway.
Yeah. Brendan, thank you. We just started to lose you there, but thank you for giving us your story of a very different Don Bosco. Zach, you're in Coburg. Have you gone to the Sydney Road version?
Oh, yes, that's what I was wanted to call in about. So it's my child that goes to Don Bosco crying in the background.
How old?
He's 19 months. It's not about the sale necessarily, but I'll try and get my wife to look after him. So the kids go there, you know, all the time. It's just a fabulous spot for birthday parties and, you know, shelter in cold weather and stuff like that. And we just found out it was being sold. So a lot of people in the community were really devastated.
For a 19-month-old, Zach, what's there for him?
What's there for him? Trampolines, rabbits.
the rabbits.
you know, it's a great way to learn, you know, to be kind to pets. There's parrots and things like that. So it's a really different kind of play centre in terms of it's a bit random, but the kids just love it. And my 5-year-old as well goes there.
Mm. Full disclosure, I agree. You sort of walk through there and you feel like you've walked into a different world. We heard earlier in the conversation now, Zach, Mark called up again, a dad, who said, look, you know, we live in the inner north. We know there are pressures with the housing. Do you suspect or fear that that will be the immovable tide that grabs Don Bosco?
Turn it into apartments or housing. Mm. Yeah. I imagine that would be the case. 100%. Yeah.
Yeah.
It'd be a real shame to see something not just, I mean, I only recently discovered in the last few years, but then to find out what an iconic and thing it is and the service that it's been giving to the community for so long. Like, if you want to go to an equivalent play centre with a couple of kids, it's easy to just spend $100, you know.
Yeah, that's absolutely true.
This is free. and if you're paying a party for your kids, which is, you know, it can easily be $1,000, this is like $200. You know?
Yeah. Zach, thank you so much for calling in. And anyone else who also is just hearing about this, there's a sign that went up, but it's been happening pretty quickly, this news. As I said, we will continue to ask questions of the local council and the state government. There is an online petition, but we're interested in what also just the role of these youth clubs mean to you, especially one that's been around for so long. This on text, I was always amazed at how one whistle controlled every kid on those trampolines at Don Bosco. They knew when their time was up. No protesting. Yeah, tell me about your stories when it comes to Don Bosco and youth clubs. You're on The Conversation Hour, 774 ABC Melbourne and Victoria. Now, talking of young people, you might have heard some official stats a few weeks ago that says we're moving around jobs less. The job mobility is less. We're either choosing to stay stuck or getting stuck in those jobs. At the time, we looked into what that means about our psychology, what it means for us generally in our job prospects, but what does it mean about the productivity? In particular, what does it mean for young people if they're not moving around the jobs? Does it make them less adventurous? Does it make them less entrepreneurial? We'll talk about that next.
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
As I said, there were those numbers that came through a couple of months ago. In 1989, almost one in five people in our workforce changed jobs in any given year. By 2005, there was one in 10. So what does that mean, not just for us as individuals, the factors in our lives that are making us stay put, the cost of living and that sort of thing? What does it mean more generally for how our economy works, for our productivity, and particularly when it comes to young people. I'm intrigued. I'd love to hear your thoughts too. Are young people potentially becoming less entrepreneurial, whether that's out of something in their lives? Maybe it is the cost of living. What do you think? 1300 222 774 is the number to call. Are young people becoming more risk averse when it comes to jobs? Christopher Carter is a PhD candidate in economics at the University of Technology in Sydney and has written recently on what he believes might be the outcomes to this immobility, relative immobility. He joins me now. Thanks, Christopher, for joining us.
Good morning, Mary. Thanks for having me on the program.
Let's start with this idea about young people and entrepreneurial instincts, I guess. What is the connection that you're drawing between those stats that we've heard about and productivity, entrepreneurial productivity when it comes to our kids?
Yeah, so our research sort of looked at the role of aging in job mobility, and we found that it's really quite important, and for two distinct ways. So the first one is just the fact of the demographics of the workers themselves. We know that younger people are more likely to change jobs compared to older workers, and the workforce has just gotten older on average over time. However, and as you mentioned in the question, there's a second more important way in which age can affect job mobility, and that's entrepreneurship. So we know that higher rates of entrepreneurship and the creation of new businesses makes the labor market more competitive. So more new firms making more attractive job offers, which should promote job switching. And we know that there's an important age component here as well. So aging has also been known to affect the rates of entrepreneurship, which have fallen as well. And so we know that this age story is wrapped up in job mobility in multiple ways. And it's particularly relevant, as you mentioned, because job mobility declines have been the sort of largest more recently for the youngest workers.
And do you, is it of a significant statistical scale that you think it represents a trend, Christopher?
Yeah, definitely. So you mentioned that halving from the late 1980s until 2005, and we found that that first demographic shift that I mentioned can more or less explain that in the entirety of that decline. But since around the GFC of 2008, we're seeing that younger workers have declined their job switching in a particularly large magnitude of about half, whereas for the oldest cohort of workers, it's more or less remained flat and even actually gone up a little bit for the oldest male workers. So, yeah, definitely something of note.
I know you've got your PhD candidacy in economics and not psychology here, Christopher, so forgive me if I'm leading you down a path. But I guess many people would think of entrepreneurial instincts as being innate. You're pointing to something about it being, you know, in a part of our environment as well. How important are these factors when it comes to promoting adventurousness, if you like, in terms of young people and their careers?
Yeah, definitely. It's a really interesting idea. And as you sort of mentioned, I'm not sure how much I can comment on the sort of psychology of it. But what we do know from the research is that these entrepreneurial skills are something that are developed and honed over time. So what we can see in the research is that as the workforce ages, people stay in the labor market for longer and they tend to retire later. And so we know that experience in high-level positions within a business gives the people the sort of skills and business acumen they need to go out and be adventurous and start their own businesses. But obviously, as the workforce ages, sort of older, more established workers are staying in these positions for longer, and younger workers don't get into these positions and develop those skills until later on in their career. So that research is sort of showing that as less young people get the skills they need to start these businesses, we would see less, you know, entrepreneurship and new business creation. And that's important because we know that that's going to improve competition and improve job mobility.
You're listening to Christopher Carter. We're talking about increasing job immobility. I'm asking you as well, do you think that we're lacking in entrepreneurial instincts? Is it just standing to reason. This on text from Dorothy: when people are faced with uncertainty, we're more conservative and risk averse. Do you agree? 1300 222 774. Or maybe you've got a young person in your life who's the entrepreneur. I'd love to hear about them as well. Christopher, you also have written saying, look, it's not always a good thing to have job mobility. Partly this is good news that we're seeing. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, so I guess making a blanket statement saying we need more job switching wouldn't be so correct. We know that, you know, changing jobs isn't automatically a good thing. If people were constantly changing because they couldn't find a good enough position, then this definitely wouldn't be a good sign. And it would be really costly for the businesses who constantly would be needing to replace people. But that being said, we know that changing jobs is still associated with a lot of good things and indicates a lot of, you know, good and healthy things going on in our labour market. We know that people tend to get the largest pay rises when they change jobs, and people who actually move on these outside options, and they produce benefits for those who don't switch. So their current employers need to make sure that they're making competitive offers and pay rises in order to retain them. When people change jobs, they bring new ideas to the new businesses, and they can also improve how well suited their skill sets are to what the job needs and what that business needs. So we know that this is like strongly linked to productivity, and that benefits everyone.
I'd love to hear from people about the shortest job stint they've ever had. 1300 222 774. Yes, even though this we're talking about long-term trends, all of us in our lives have had some job immobility. What's the shortest stint in any job you've had? We've got some minutes left in the conversation hour. Call me up, 1300 222 774. I'm talking about this with Christopher Carter, who's from the University of Technology in Sydney. And also, Christopher, you talk about the retiring age affecting the job mobility for young people. What are we seeing there in terms of trends?
Yeah, so we can point to some really nice research which really clearly establishes a link that as people retire later, it means that younger people and face increased competition from older workers for job positions, and we know that younger people on average are more likely to change jobs, and they benefit more from changing jobs. So this sort of effect 100% impacts the job mobility rate that we see, and so.
So in other words, we should all retire. We should all retire for the youth.
It's difficult to say the sort of overall welfare. We know that you know, people who have been in their careers for a long time have developed a wealth of skills and experience that they're able to utilize. So it's hard to sort of make an objective statement on what's bad and what's good, but we know that these things are definitely having an effect in our labor market over time, and I think it's important to be wary of that.
You've got a few minutes to call or text. Tell me the shortest time you've been in a job, or maybe how many jobs you've had in your life. Tell me who can break the record there. Christopher, when you look at all of these various parts that play in productivity, which is the buzzword here in Australia, we need more of it. What needs to change? What are the sort of the policy levers that you would think need to help, in particularly in these times of great uncertainty, as we say, and a lot of pressure?
Yeah, so like I said, what we're seeing in terms of what's driving lower job mobility, not all of these are particularly cause for concern. So we know that post-COVID, there was some of that job satisfaction, which might have contributed to lower job mobility. But there are definitely some other factors, as we've been talking about, the entrepreneurial piece and labour market competition. So more new firms and businesses entering the market and making competitive, attractive job offers, which will entice people to change jobs. We know that promoting labour market competition is a really important policy direction, which we definitely need to look at. And in addition to this, there's also recent research on non-compete clauses. So we know that these may be directly handcuffing workers when they are thinking about changing jobs. And we know that the current government is looking into that and making actions on that right now.
Christopher, thank you for bringing us your analysis today.
Thanks so much, Mary. Appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
That's Christopher Carter, who's a PhD candidate in economics, University of Sydney, University of Technology in Sydney. This on text, we've regulated initiative out of society. You need a permit to breathe these days. Also on the text line, there have been some references to recent reporting about the Christian Brothers selling real estate for $1. This is, people were drawing potential links between that and the sale of Don Bosco. It must be said that in the reporting around this sale that it definitely has been put up with a millions-dollar price tag, so that is not necessarily something that is involved. This on text, Catholic Church could make reparations for past wrongs and ensure Don Bosco is saved for the community. And this as well, Don Bosco is the best, oh no, so inclusive and such a source of enabling good choices for those with few options. This is the outcome of community development not being a key outcome of redevelopment of inner Melbourne. Local government isn't supported by the state government to require the retention or relocation of funds contribution for community facilities like this. Very sad and bad. That on text as well. This on text, my first job was my shortest, lasted one day as bush fairy. I decided fairly early on that sitting on a toadstool while wearing a hessian sack wasn't for me. Yeah, I think that's about the same. My first job at 15, says this texter, many years ago with a mother pushing me to go to work. I went to a department store. I lasted one day. Horrible supervisor, couldn't see the point, went back to school. Thank you for those stories, and thank you for joining me on the Conversation Hour today. Join me again tomorrow on the Conversation Hour from 11 in Melbourne and across Victoria.